Welcome. It's good to be with you. All right, let's get into what we're exploring today. I had a conversation last week with someone who was really feeling like the world is unraveling. That's not an uncommon feeling, as far as I can tell. I feel like in talking with other people who are in the people helping realm, for example, these conversations about how to find our balance in the world under the current circumstances is something that's challenging for lots of people. And most of these people are not people, for instance, that are living in an active war zone, which I would imagine would make those sorts of feelings much more acute. And the fact that in some cases would equal needing to run for your literal life to another country. That's not a space that I have the experience to enter, but it's an important one to think about. The person that I was talking with is a parent. They have university age kids. And those kids, I think, are also sort of often feeling like their future is on fire. And that sensation has not been helped by things like a global pandemic and a war that is close enough to home culturally and even geographically to disrupt our lives a bit. And a media industry that thrives on things like selling things like fear and division. And I don't think I was much of a comfort to the person in this particular conversation, although often just talking about all of those feelings can help us to live with them in much healthier ways. Beats the daylights out of another one of my grandfather's idioms, beats the daylights out of keeping it inside and just trying to tamp it down all the time. That is not good to do. My perspective was and is that most of these sort of larger themes that I was just talking about, specifics notwithstanding, these are all things that have happened before in human history. It's just that they haven't happened to us. They haven't happened in our lifetimes. And so within our life experience, they are unusual. And that can be quite distressing. My hope in mentioning that in our conversation, this conversation with this person I'm talking about, was to offer the possibility of another perspective, maybe a little bit of a wider lens. And that sort of backing up a little bit and trying to say, what's the context for these experiences we're having? That can be one of the ways that we keep hope alive when things are difficult. One of the ways that we can sort of get our eyes a little bit higher off of ourselves and our immediate concerns, not in a blithe or denial sort of way, but onto considering the long game, onto considering the wider context for these experiences we're having and these feelings we're feeling. And it can help us, I think, especially if we're struggling with a victim mentality or sort of feeling trapped in a cycle of unanswerable questions. And when it comes to unanswerable human questions, the core unanswerable human question when we're suffering is often, why me? And I'm not going to explore this today, but I can remember feeling quite liberated when I learned that many of the monastics, many of the early monks, whose sort of centeredness seemed enviable to me, at least at a distance, when they addressed themselves to this why me question, they often did it by turning it on its head and asking instead, why not me? Right? Why should I be exempt from human suffering? Why should difficult things not also come my way? And that's a pretty interesting question to reflect on, especially if we want to learn more about the assumptions, often the unconscious assumptions, that are built into our own worldviews. Spending a bit of time asking why not me about whatever it is that we're experiencing as challenges or suffering can often surface some rather indefensible and hard to support beliefs. And some of those may well point toward things like personal entitlement or beliefs about what we should have or how we ought to be treated by those around us. And some of them might point toward wider assumptions about ideas like how the economy works or big ideas like the inevitability or sustainability of economic expansion. So the idea water can get pretty deep pretty fast when we start asking questions like, why not me? In any case, that conversation was rattling around in my head this week when I bumped into a reminder of just how near at hand another perspective is for any of us that want to be or are open to being taught by it. I don't remember where I read this, except that I can say with reasonable confidence that it was in the June print edition of Maclean's magazine. The author of whatever article I was reading pointed out a very basic difference between the broad strokes of many worldviews formed by the history of Western thought and the broad strokes of many of those formed within indigenous thought. And I was struck by the starkness of the gap, between a worldview or worldviews that assumes that we are self-sufficient and things are stable, except when there is a problem, at which time we may need to reach out for some support, versus worldviews that start with the assumption that we are always fragile and don't have a hope of making it without interdependence. And I'm presenting those as, you know, two complete worldviews, kind of intact with boundaries. And obviously things can be more fluid than that. And yet those broad strokes, as I called them, characterize in many ways that I think are fair, those different sources for a view of the world. That it is normal in the world always to need one another is not necessarily a hallmark of our prevailing cultural norms in this part of the world at this moment in history. If it was, we probably wouldn't find it so daunting to ask for help, would we? The voices in our head that say, don't be too needy, might dial it back a bit if we were starting with the assumption that we are all needy, and that our need for one another is mutual and foundational, that our need for one another is a condition of being one part of the web of life here on this planet, rather than existing as individuals somewhere near the pinnacle of life on this planet. The stretch of land just outside the window, and I often reference this window, it feels like an important reality touchstone for me when I'm messing with ideas, you know, as we do here at the table. It's a fairly wide earthen and hardscaped dike because we live next to a creek, and I guess it used to flood back in the day, and so the province built a big dike there. And then there's a row of elm trees, fairly mature elm trees, which just dust their seeds everywhere. They fill up the eaves troughs in about 5 minutes. But they also plant little elm seedlings all over that dike. There's thousands of them. Thousands of little trees, all sort of working hard to sequester our carbon. And, you know, as a sort of suburban person, I look out there and go, oh, there's little trees like all over the lawn sometimes. And then other times I look out there and I'm like, you know, that is nature doing what nature does. And I should stand back and enjoy that and appreciate it and watch it happen and nurture it even if I can, instead of trying to knock it back into a particular ordered form that suggests that my preferences in the world are the way that the world should be shaped. Anyway, a divergence, but a commentary on seeing ourselves as part of the whole web rather than as the pinnacle of the web, making everything else fit us. In our context here at the table, acknowledging that we share this continent in particular by virtue of having been made welcome by peoples whose working assumption was that the settlers, when we arrived here, were here to join the circle of interdependence, and that we would all be better off if we did, that seems to me like as good a way as any of getting at the root issues a bit more substantially, rather than simply saying, oh yeah, we need to remember that we signed these treaties way back when. And of course the treaties are important, and of course they need to be honored. And sometimes it feels to me like we can do a better job of that if we kind of get down off our horse of conquest and ask a question like, why not me? I can't say a sentence like that without carrying with me in a conscious way what you shared, Judy, about your own health this week. I do not wish to ask the question, why not me, about what you are experiencing. Because it raises the possibility of me suffering like you are suffering. And so on. Like, that's an immediate in community context shared with us this morning illustration of the sorts of dilemmas that kind of question surfaces. And so I'm not suggesting it's for all of us all the time. I think it could be overwhelming, but I would be willing to suggest that it should be for all of us some of the time. That is a question we need to ask. Now, in my head, where many interesting things happen, in my head, this is all connected to our current consideration of seeing religions in 3D. So I'm going to drag a bit of what's in my head out into the light of day and see if it still feels connected when I make it explicit. You, of course, need to be the judge. When we left off on May the 15th, I had suggested that we consider religions as wisdom traditions and as means of transformation. And we'd looked a little bit at how that transformation piece might go sideways, but we also considered how a historical long view take on what religions tend to be most on about, which is the transformation of the self in the direction of being more compassionate human beings, can help us to troubleshoot some of those dangers. And I said at that time that I had one more idea, but I was going to leave it for another time. This is that time. This is that idea. I wasn't trying to make it more important or momentous somehow. I was just running out of time on the 15th. But here it is. Here's the idea. Religions, in addition to being thought of as wisdom traditions and means of transformation, can be thought of as sacraments of the sacred. Methinks we should define our terms. If you've grown up around religion, as I did, you might have at least a passing familiarity with the word sacraments. In most of the Protestant traditions, there are two sacraments, baptism and communion. And like many things religious, of course, there's been plenty of scraps about what qualifies as a sacrament and what doesn't. The Catholic tradition, for example, has another five for a perfect total of seven. In any case, what the word sacrament means in this context is something like the use of visible signs, so words, actions, material objects, to invoke what is invisible and transcendent. The use of visible signs, words, actions, and material objects to invoke what is invisible and transcendent. And those things are often expressed and practiced in symbolic rituals. And as we've done with the word sacred, I want to invite us to consider a wider meaning for the word sacrament. So wider than that. We've talked a couple of times about the idea offered by Wendell Berry that there are no unsacred places, only sacred and desecrated places. And we've considered how that points toward ways that the mystery of more or the mystery of spirit can be present everywhere, and that the presence of mystery is what makes something sacred. It's quite a little string of ideas there, but I'm going to carry on. In light of that, we could think of a sacrament as a mediator of the sacred, or a mediator of more or spirit, words that we've been using sort of interchangeably with the word sacred. Maybe we could think of a sacrament like a handle for mystery, or a way or ways of wrestling with what is not us, what is beyond us. Or if we're not that angsty for wrestling and all of that, or if we're more inclined towards certainty, we could perhaps think of a sacrament as being a way of grasping some aspect of that which is not us. So, at least for the purposes of our exploration today, I'm going to say that a sacrament is anything finite and visible through which more or spirit becomes visible to us. Sacrament is anything finite and visible through which more or spirit becomes visible, or we could say accessible, might be a wider word there, to us. When we work with a definition like that, it's not hard to see that almost anything can, and even that almost everything has, been a way that what is beyond us has been mediated to someone at some point. And there are some obvious themes. There's obvious kind of biggies that get used more often, if you will, for this kind of access. Things that transport us and move us toward transcendence tend to fall into this category. So big obvious themes would be things like nature or art or music, perhaps. And I mean, obviously ritual attached to all of those. Here's where this connects to our exploration of religions and where I hope it can widen our view of what religions are or what they can be. If we apply that definition of sacrament that I was just talking about to religion, then we might consider that the purpose of religion is to mediate the sacred. The purpose of religion is to give those engaging in religious life and rituals ways of moving toward the mystery. That feels pretty different from most of what religions tend to get press for, doesn't it? It might even feel like it kind of gently assails. Can you do that? Can you gently assail? I hope so. It might even feel like it kind of gently assails this bumper sticker idea of, you know, I'm spiritual but not religious, which, by the way, is an idea I take seriously. So me calling it a bumper sticker idea is simply to say that there's something reductionistic about it. It's a short, pithy way of saying something enormous and complex. If our spirituality or our spiritual practices exist to help us mediate spirit, and religious rituals exist for that same purpose, what's the difference? So if both our spirituality and our religion existed to do the same thing, what's the difference between them? Why would we at this point in history feel like it's important or a meaningful distinction to say, I'm spiritual but not religious? Well, lots of ways we could take that on. In fact, there is an old Talkie-Bit podcast about it way back when. I can't even remember how far back, but that was just on that question. But for our purposes today, I'm going to suggest that maybe one reason is because we can be religious without being spiritual. Within the last 300 years or so, since the Enlightenment, basically, there's been this enormous emphasis within the Christian tradition on believing. And more particularly, there's been a powerful gatekeeping sort of emphasis on right belief. Within the tradition, staggering resources have been poured into making sure the next generation knows what constitutes right belief. The religious education that any number of people within our own community have received would have been impossible without being heavily subsidized by communities and individuals that believed that it was essential that the next generation know what constitutes right belief. And that's often been connected quite directly to ritual. My own journey within the Christian tradition, for instance, I've been baptized in three different ways, all of which were the right one. That's why when I came into a different community, they were like, are you baptized? And I was like, yeah, how did you get baptized this way? Oh, that won't do. We have to baptize you the right way. So I think I've got it covered at this point. When I reflect on that, though, part of what comes readily to mind is Adam Cohen's observation in his song, Put Your Bags Down, that, quote, the God of small things has so many rules. There are lots of problems with the idea that right belief is the heart of, in this case, Christianity, or of any religion for that matter. But one key problem is that that belief can interfere with the possibility that religion itself, and this is the crux of what I'm sort of on about this morning in this talkie bit, it can interfere with the possibility that religion itself could function like a sacrament. Religion itself could function like something that mediates the sacred to those that access it. So, as many people have experienced, when religion stops functioning like a sacrament, it can make it all but impossible to be both spiritual and religious. Hence, I'm spiritual, but not religious. If I'm forced to choose between right belief and being part of something that can help me touch that more that is calling out to me, I might just choose what can help. On this next point in particular, and in some ways perhaps in this whole series, I could sound like I'm advocating for the recovery of religion or something along those lines, and that is not how I see it. What I am advocating for is something that I would say is bigger than that, because I continue to believe that there is more to life than I can see or know directly. And because I believe that even if we can't cause or control that more, we do have agency in seeking it. And because I believe that even the hint of it can transform us into more loving, compassionate people, I'm on about whatever will tilt us in that direction. Religion as right belief doesn't seem to be doing a great job of that, and I'm not a fan. Religion as sacrament might be another matter. And by religion as sacrament, I mean religion not as a destination, but as an entry point. If we think of religion as a sacrament, we're thinking of it as something not that we should believe in, but that we enter into so that it can mediate the sacred to us. That's why we are there. That's why we're practicing that. That's why we're engaging in that. When we participate in religion, when we contribute to the making of a religion, we are contributing to something finite and visible through which more or spirit might become visible or accessible. If that is not what is happening, it doesn't necessarily mean that our religion is something awful, but it might mean that we're participating in something within which we can be religious but not spiritual. And if our hunger is for more than that, then we might find ourselves needing to leave or at least augment that experience of religion. However, I believe that it remains possible to approach religion as a sacrament, if we choose to do so, to enter into its practices and rituals not as expressions of right belief, but as ways in which the finite or visible is helping to make what is not visible, what is mysterious, what is spirit, visible or tangible to us. And when we come at it that way, our mission becomes engagement. Our mission becomes the entering into whatever the practices are, such that we invite or allow the sacrament to mediate the sacred to us. It's the sacred that is transformative, and the sacrament that helps us approach it. So if we think of religion as a sacrament, that's religion's whole job, is to help us approach the sacred. To help us approach what is mysterious, what is spirit, what is more. Now, if there are no unsacred places, as Barry suggests, if everything can be sacred, then it seems to me that our desire, our human desire to connect with mystery, might be well served by having more rituals in our bag than just those provided by a particular religion. That might not be an appealing idea to everyone. Some of us would be better served, frankly, by digging deeper and deeper into a particular set of rituals or practices, because that's what will most effectively mediate the sacred to us. But for some of us, just the possibility that spirit might be everywhere is pretty nearly irresistible. The thought that religion doesn't have a corner on mediating the sacred is enticing, liberating. We want to explore it, but we've got this voice in the back of our minds, or maybe right up front yelling at the top of our lungs, that to do so would be to abandon the truth, by which the voice tends to mean right belief. Now, as always, I am not saying I've got this cornered, or that any thinking person would agree with me. With that important caveat in mind, I am willing to suggest that if we're having that experience, it might be helpful to ask ourselves some questions. This list is not exhaustive, it's a starter, but let me suggest three possible questions that might help us to probe that. Does my religion or my experience in a religious context mediate spirit or mystery or more to me? Does it do that? Does it do the thing that a sacrament exists to do? If not, why not? And if so, on what scale? Or to maybe put it a better way, if so, with what limits? So religions are often good at, for example, saying, here's how, in this context, we're going to sort of experience God. And if you're experiencing God in some way other than this, that's not God. That's dangerous. That's a slippery slope. You have to be a little careful with that one. It can get out of control. Where did we ever get the idea that if we're encountering the mystery that is not us, that we're in control? Anyway, and so on, right? We're familiar things. We'll all have our own stories. But that's what, if so, with what limits? That's what that question points toward. And then, in light of answering those questions for ourselves as honestly as we can in the moment, with what we have to work with, and that changes over time, we can consider whether what we're experiencing within our religious context, or what we have experienced within our religious context, we can consider whether that is opening us to more or not. That's what that set of questions points toward, is the consideration of that question. And I wanted to leave us with those because of my own belief, which again, you may not share, and I'm not insisting that everyone should, but just so you know where I'm coming from, disclosure here. I would say that those questions matter because I believe that whatever else we're looking for when we explore what we believe, if what we're finding is making our world smaller, it's probably not sacred. I'm going to leave it there. Good to be with you all. And thanks for gathering this way.